Hi, I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! For more than 15 years, CJSF 90.1 FM has been bringing Democracy Now! To the greater Vancouver area every weekday at 11 a.m. Is Democracy Now!
Today, as Israel fights on the front line of civilization, I too appeal to America. Give us the tools faster, and we'll finish the job faster.
Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu addresses a joint session of Congress as thousands protest outside in Washington, D.C., calling for a ceasefire, a hostage deal, and Netanyahu's arrest for committing war crimes in Gaza. More than 100 lawmakers skipped the speech, as did Vice President Kamala Harris. We'll talk to Palestinian-American legal scholar Noor Erekat and Phyllis Bennis of the Institute for Policy Studies. Then we speak with two-piece activists, one Israeli, one Palestinian, who are working together to end the war in Gaza and build a lasting peace.
I'm a peace activist. I lost my parents, and I believe that peace is possible. I know that peace is possible, and this is what me and my partners, Palestinian and Israeli partners, are working on now, day and night, to bring peace to this land.
Maoz Inon's parents were killed on October 7th. Aziz Abu Sada's 19-year-old brother died after being tortured in an Israeli prison. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu addressed a joint session of the U.S. Congress Wednesday, thanking the Biden administration for supporting Israel's assault on Gaza, which has killed over 39,000 Palestinians, and pledging to carry on until Israel achieves total victory.
Our world is in upheaval. In the Middle East, Iran's axis of terror confronts America, Israel, and our Arab friends. This is not a clash of civilizations. It's a clash between barbarism and civilization.
Netanyahu also falsely accused Iran of funding the pro-Palestinian demonstrations taking place outside the Capitol yesterday.
Well, I have a message for these protesters. When the tyrants of Tehran, who hang gays from cranes and murder women for not covering their hair, are praising, promoting, and funding you, you have officially become Iran's useful idiots.
While many of her colleagues skipped the speech, Michigan Democrat Rashida Tlaib, the only Palestinian-American in Congress, held up a sign that read guilty of genocide on one side and war criminal on the other as she watched the proceedings. In a statement, Tlaib wrote, quote, "It's a sad day for our democracy when my colleagues will smile for a photo op with a man who's actively committing genocide," she said. About half of House and Senate Democrats, more than 100 lawmakers, chose not to attend Netanyahu's address. Many of them gathered at a side event to call for a ceasefire. Netanyahu's meeting with President Biden at the White House today. He'll also meet separately with Vice President Kamala Harris. She did not preside over yesterday's joint session of Congress that Netanyahu addressed. On Friday, Netanyahu is scheduled to meet with Donald Trump at his Mar-a-Lago resort. Outside the Capitol, thousands of protesters took to the streets. At least 23 were arrested. Police deployed chemical spray on peaceful demonstrators. At one point, protesters hoisted the Palestinian flag in front of Union Station and issued notice of a citizen's arrest against Netanyahu. This is a Palestinian-American protester.
I'm here to raise awareness about the genocide and ethnic cleansing that's happening in Gaza, as well as the West Bank. And I'm really hopeful that this is going to bring meaningful change to 75 years of oppression. And it's finally making international headlines. And I want to be part of history.
Many unionized workers also attended the protest against Netanyahu.
We have a moral obligation to speak out about when our products are being used for purposes that we never agreed to. We're UAW's for a strong national defense for herself and her allies, but when weapon systems are being used for genocide, like, we have to speak out.
Daniel Vicente is with United Auto Workers. This week, seven of the country's most powerful unions, including the UAW and SEIU, issued a joint call to the Biden administration to immediately halt all military funding to Israel. A group of 45 U.S. doctors, surgeons and nurses who volunteered in Gaza since October 7th have written an open letter to President Biden and Vice President Kamala Harris demanding an immediate ceasefire and an international arms embargo against Israel. The group of health workers include evidence of a much higher death toll than is usually cited, more than 92,000 people, which represents over 4% of Gaza's population, they said. They write, quote, "With only marginal exceptions, everyone in Gaza is sick, injured, or both. Israel's continued repeated displacement of the malnourished and sick population of Gaza, half of whom are children, to areas with no running water or even toilets available is absolutely shocking," they said. CNN has found Israel is blocking physicians with Palestinian heritage from entering Gaza as part of international humanitarian missions. This all comes as Israel intensifies its attacks against civilians in Khan Yunis and across the Gaza Strip. In Deir al-Balah, doctors at Al-Aqsa Hospital were able to save newborn baby Yassin after his mother and other family members were killed in an Israeli airstrike on Nusayrat. This is the baby's grandfather, who has lost multiple children to Israel's assault, including Yassin's mother, Ola.
She was holding on to the hope of being able to hold her baby. She never expected she would become a martyr. She wanted to hold her child and fill our home with his presence. She would say, "Mom, hopefully this will make up for the loss of my martyred brothers and bring life back to our home."
President Biden addressed his decision to drop out of the presidential race Wednesday evening in a televised address from the Oval Office.
Nothing can come in the way of saving our democracy. That includes personal ambition. So I've decided the best way forward is to pass the torch to a new generation.
President Biden threw his support behind Kamala Harris, calling her experienced, tough, and capable. This comes as the DNC set August 1st as a date for a virtual roll call to officially nominate the Democratic presidential nominee. On Wednesday, as Prime Minister Netanyahu addressed Congress, Vice President Harris delivered a keynote address at a gathering of the Zeta Phi Beta sorority in Indianapolis.
Donald Trump, former president, handpicked three members of the United States Supreme Court because he intended for them to overturn Roe v. Wade. The United States Supreme Court, previously the court of Thurgood and RBG. And as he intended, they did. Well, let me tell you something. When I am president of the United States, and when Congress passes a law to restore those freedoms, I will sign it into law.
In other election news, J.D. Vance's views on women and the LGBTQ community have come under the spotlight following his nomination as Trump's running mate. In this 2021 interview with former Fox News host Tucker Carlson, Vance attacks Kamala Harris, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, and Pete Buttigieg, claiming people without children should not be involved in policy decisions.
We're effectively run in this country via the Democrats, via our corporate oligarchs, by a bunch of childless cat ladies who are miserable at their own lives and the choices that they've made, and so they want to make the rest of the country miserable, too. And it's just a basic fact. You look at Kamala Harris, Pete Buttigieg, AOC, the entire future of the Democrats is controlled by people without children.
Also in 2021, Vance advocated for a voting system that would allow people with children to cast more votes on behalf of their children. In other news about J.D. Vance, the Republican vice presidential nominee has written the foreword to a forthcoming book by Kevin Roberts, president of the Heritage Foundation and head of Project 2025. Trump's campaign has disavowed any connection to Project 2025, a radical Republican blueprint to overhaul U.S. policy on everything from immigration to reproductive rights to the climate. In Taiwan, at least three people are dead and nine crew members are missing after their cargo ship sank amidst heavy winds and rain whipped up by Typhoon Gaimi. Earlier, the storm left a path of destruction in the Philippines, where much of the capital, Manila, remains underwater. At least 22 people were killed in the Philippines. An oil tanker capsized off the coast. More than 600,000 people have been displaced.
The effect of this on residents is trauma, fear, uncertainty, and worry, since the flooded waters continue to rise at this moment.
And a series of climate actions targeting airports are taking place this week. In Europe, activists from the German group Last Generation temporarily grounded flights at the Frankfurt and Cologne airports by gluing themselves to the tarmac. The activists have been calling on the German government to divest from oil, gas, and coal by 2030. In the UK, police arrested at least seven members of the direct action group Just Stop Oil Wednesday as they cycled towards London's Heathrow Airport ahead of a planned protest action. Direct actions at or near airports have also been reported in Austria, Finland, Switzerland, Norway, and in Canada, where on Wednesday, Last Generation activists blocked access to Montreal International Airport for hours, demanding an end to fossil fuels. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. Coming up, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu addresses a joint session of Congress as thousands of protesters rallied outside calling for a ceasefire, a hostage deal, and Netanyahu's arrest for committing war crimes in Gaza. Stay with us. Psychic Death by Bikini Kill. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. This is War, Peace, and the Presidency. I'm Amy Goodman.
And I'm Nermeen Sheikh. Welcome to our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world. Thousands of protesters took to the streets of Washington, D.C. Wednesday as Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu addressed a joint session of Congress. Netanyahu had been invited by Republican and Democratic congressional leaders. The speech came 2 months after Karim Khan, the chief prosecutor of the International Criminal Court, announced he was seeking an arrest warrant for Netanyahu for committing war crimes in Gaza. During his speech, Netanyahu thanked the U.S. for its support and defended Israel's actions in Gaza.
The prosecutor of the International Criminal Court has shamefully accused Israel of deliberately starving the people of Gaza. This is utter, complete nonsense. It's a complete fabrication. Israel has enabled more than 40,000 aid trucks to enter Gaza. That's 500,000 tons of food. And that's more than 3,000 calories for every man, woman, and child in Gaza. If there are Palestinians in Gaza who aren't getting enough food, it's not because Israel is blocking it, it's because Hamas is stealing it. So much for that lie, but here's another. The ICC prosecutor accuses Israel of deliberately targeting civilians. What in God's green earth is he talking about? The IDF has dropped millions of flyers, sent millions of text messages, made hundreds of thousands of phone calls to get Palestinian civilians out of harm's way. But at the same time, Hamas does everything in its power to put Palestinian civilians in harm's way.
Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu speaking Wednesday in his fourth address to a joint session of Congress. During the speech, he made no mention of the more than 16,000 Palestinian children killed by Israel since October 7th. Netanyahu's critics said he repeatedly distorted the true picture of what's happening in Gaza. The UN says 500 aid trucks are needed every day as Gaza faces famine. On an average day, Israel allows in just over a quarter of the trucks needed. Netanyahu also never mentioned the word ceasefire during his speech. More than 100 lawmakers, mostly Democrats, skipped Netanyahu's address, including Senators Dick Durbin, Majority Whip, Chris Van Hollen, Jeff Merkley, Patty Murray, Elizabeth Warren, and Bernie Sanders. Vice President Kamala Harris declined to preside over the Senate chamber during his address. She instead was in Indianapolis. Michigan Democrat Rashida Tlaib, the only Palestinian-American in Congress, opted to attend but protested Netanyahu by holding up a sign that read guilty of genocide on one side and war criminal on the other. Ahead of Netanyahu's address, Democratic Congressmember Cori Bush discussed why she was boycotting the speech.
It's absolutely shameful that after the murder of over 39,000 Palestinians, human beings, after the repeated bombing of hospitals, after witnessing the bombing of religious institutions, schools, humanitarian convoys, refugee camps, and fathers collecting their children's remains in plastic bags, holding their beheaded children, that my colleagues in Congress choose to celebrate Prime Minister Netanyahu, a whole war criminal, by bestowing him the honor of addressing Congress. Because standing up for human rights is more than a talking point to me. I'm boycotting his address.
Outside the Capitol, thousands took part in protests calling for Netanyahu's arrest and for a U.S. arms embargo on Israel. Emerson Wolf came to the protest from Grand Rapids, Michigan.
We believe we should stop aiding Israel in their genocide against Palestinians and that they need to lift the siege on Gaza. So we're here to protest Netanyahu, but we're also here to encourage people to come out to the first day of the Democratic National Convention to keep the pressure up on the Democrats to let them know that we want a pro-Palestinian candidate, that the people demand change, and that we will not suffer this genocide anymore.
To talk more about Prime Minister Netanyahu's address to Congress and the protests, we're joined by two guests. Nora Erekat is a Palestinian-American human rights attorney, professor at Rutgers University, author of Justice for Some, Law on the Question of Palestine. Phyllis Bennis also joins us, a fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies. She serves as an international advisor to Jewish Voice for Peace. Phyllis has written a number of books, including Understanding the Palestinian-Israeli Conflict. Phyllis, you are in Washington. You were out at the protests yesterday. Can you talk about what Netanyahu said and what he didn't say, and the significance of him addressing, as a foreign leader, a joint session of Congress more than any foreign leader ever? I think Winston Churchill came in second with three addresses. This was Netanyahu's fourth.
It was a horrifying thing to see, Amy. I'm glad to be back with Democracy Now! Today. Seeing the standing ovations, by my estimate, it seemed to be about every 30 seconds, you saw members of Congress on their feet applauding and applauding and applauding. But I think that we saw two things yesterday, aside from the host of lies. Even CNN, New York Times, everybody was tracking the lies that Netanyahu was saying. I think there's two sets of things we need to notice. Inside, what this showed was the degree to which the support for Israel has become a thoroughly partisan issue, despite the fact that some Democrats supported and signed off on the invitation. The fact that more than 100 Democratic lawmakers skipped the speech, refused to participate, is a real statement of how this has become, supporting the Prime Minister of Israel, has become a political liability in a very public way for public figures across the U.S. That has not always been the case. The other thing is that this is different than what happened in 2015, when about 60 members of Congress skipped the speech. They were overwhelmingly from the Congressional Black Caucus, and they were focused not on so much on the question of the denial of Palestinian rights, what had happened just months before that visit in the attack on Gaza at that time,
that had gone on for 55 days left 2,200 Palestinian civilians killed. But they recognized the incredible racism, the disdain with which the Prime Minister of Israel treated President Barack Obama. And it was in response to that direct racism that led to this massive refusal to participate. This time around, it was straight up about the refusal to call for a ceasefire, and it was about genocide. Outside, there were two very important lessons, I think, as well. One is that our movement, the broadly defined movement, not only the self-defined Palestinian rights movement that has been around for so many decades in this country, but the broad, spontaneous movement that has risen up in the last 10 months in direct response to the horrific level of genocide that Israel has been carrying out in Gaza, that broad movement has really normalized the whole question of ending, not only cutting or conditioning, but ending U.S. military support to Gaza. It's no longer a challenging position. 62% of adults in this country, of all parties, voting and not voting, say that we should stop. They oppose sending weapons and sending material support to Israel. The second thing is that our movement has redefined the demand for a ceasefire. It has stuck to a kind of message discipline where immediate ceasefire now is the call. But what that ceasefire means is very different than what it meant 9 or 10 months ago. It now means three things. The first is stop the firing, stop the bombing, stop the tank fire, stop the ground assaults, stop killing people. But it also includes two other key points. One is the need for massive humanitarian escalation, humanitarian aid at scale of what's required, meaning start refunding UNRWA. The U.S. is now the only country that is still refusing to support the most important U.N. agency, the only one capable of providing Palestinians with the very basics of life, water, medical care, food. And the third thing that's part of a ceasefire now is to stop sending the weapons that enable the genocide. And until all three are met, this will not be the ceasefire that people are demanding. And that's the message that is being sent both to President Biden, who will be president for another 6 months, presiding over the support for this genocide, and to Vice President Kamala Harris, who is the likely nominee of the Democratic Party to be the next president, telling her what ceasefire now really means. So that was, I think, the messages that we took yesterday. It was an extraordinary mobilization in the streets of Washington.
And Phyllis Bennis, could you talk about what the significance is of Kamala Harris not being present when Netanyahu spoke?
Well, again, this was a reflection of the degree to which there's recognition that showing support for the Prime Minister of Israel has become a political liability. And Kamala Harris wanted no part of it. She also has expressed a very different tone, a very different kind of language than President Biden, so that it's quite clear that whatever policy positions she's been willing to take that differ from his, and that has meant essentially her willingness way before Biden did to call for an immediate ceasefire. And the fact that she called for it on the anniversary of Bloody Sunday in Selma, Alabama, at the foot of the Edmund Pettus Bridge that was so famous, infamous in this country's history of beating and attacking black protesters that were being denied the right to vote. That was an extraordinarily powerful moment to use that day and that place to call for an immediate ceasefire, something that her president had so far refused to do. So we know that her position is somewhat different. How much she's going to be willing to break with Biden's position, we still don't know. What is clear is that for her to take a different position will be a whole lot easier than it will be for President Biden. President Biden has responded to some of the protests, particularly that of the uncommitted movement, as well as the massive numbers of people on staff of the administration and of Congress demanding of the president that he stop supporting this, saying they can't do their jobs to represent this country as long as he's maintaining that position. for a President Harris in the future, she would not have to be denying decades of uncritical, massive support for Israel that have been reflected by Joe Biden. And in that context, I think there is some hope. I think that's part of the reason that so many young people, people of color, particularly, we're seeing it among people who supported the uncommitted movement, people in the Palestinian and Arab communities in this country, are saying, well, maybe there's a chance here. Maybe there's a way that she could do something that would make it possible to vote for her. There, that's not clear yet. She has not earned that vote yet. But it does look like she's taking a very different position than the person that she has served as, essentially, as his deputy. So I think it was very, very important that she refused to participate in this. She refused to have her photograph central right above this man who was taking on a speech in the People's House, as people like to call it here in Washington, in the Capitol, our Capitol, using it as if, as CNN said, as the New York Times said, as all the mainstream media is acknowledging, treating it as if he were giving a State of the Union address, inviting his own guests to sit in the balcony and addressing them, making them the subject of it, speaking for an entire hour with ovation after ovation. And apparently, Kamala Harris wanted no part of that. So there's a significance in that different approach that she has taken.
Well, I'd like to bring in Noura Erekat. Noura, if you could also respond to Netanyahu's speech and what was most striking to you. I mean, the number of times the audience broke into this enthusiastic applause.
I think that that was probably the most disturbing, because for those of us who have followed this for 292 days now, we have understood the blatant lies that the Israel has said, that all of its apologists have made. But to watch U.S. Congress jubilantly cheer on, scramble over one another in order to cheer for essentially what is a war on children. When Netanyahu says they want to finish the job is annihilation. It is extermination. It is genocide. They have flattened all of Gaza. It is reported that it will take 10 to 15 years just to clean up the rubble. There are no hospitals. Children cannot be treated. There is now a spread of polio. And U.S. Congress is applauding for this jubilantly, at one point breaking out into a chant of USA, USA. And so as I watch that, one of the things that occurs to me is how the debate within the United States approaching the election in November has taken on the stance that there is a demarcation or a distinction between foreign policy and domestic policy, what happens over there and what happens at home, as if those things are not entwined and imbricated. Right now, those chants at home echo an entitlement to kill. Echo an entitlement to plunder, to destroy lives that are not seen or deemed worthy, and where racism and colonialism is not a dog whistle, but is on full display. So for those who are concerned about saving their democracy at home, I want to tell them that there is no democracy to save that manifests itself in ongoing genocide in this way. Consider that your fellow Palestinian Americans, Arab Americans, American Muslims have been subject to a fascist regime at home already, not only in being forced to watch a genocide for which we are punished for naming, but also to have anti-terrorism act being leveled against those of us who are protesting U.S. policy, who are entreating the United States to follow its own law, the National Security Memorandum Number 20, the Arms Export Control Act, the Leahy Amendment, insisting that the U.S. cannot continue even at the bare minimum to transfer arms to a belligerent state that is violating U.S. and international law. Palestinian, Arab American, American Muslims have been attacked, have been stabbed, have been run over. And yet you are telling us that we have to save a democracy at home. We are not living in a democracy, and the worst is yet to come. And for those who are watching helplessly because they think Congress is beyond reach and out of hand, this is local as well. This extends down to your community and your university, where university administrators have called on cops in order to punish students who are excellent students, who, contrary to what